Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
How are we started?
No, we're not started yet. I have to get my questions.
Okay.
Which are in this bag. And I have them. And I should probably introduce you. I don't know. How would I introduce you? Kurt Collins, who's has a wonderful blog site called Blue Blurry Lines. And I've kind of met him on Facebook. And it looks like he's been researching UFOs or been interested in it for a long time. We're going to talk about that. And to be honest, when I first talked to him, I first saw what he was talking about, I was kind of scared. It's like, is he trying to, like, you know? But I think he has the same mindset as me, as far as I can tell. It's, you know, I would like to see what's going on. I would like to see what's going on with these cases. I would like to stop having people believe in things just because other people have repeated them for a long time and clear out the cases, at least the UFO cases and some of the things that are, you know, that are discoverable. The sources and the causes of them are discoverable, so we can concentrate on ones that probably are unknown and try and figure out what those are, whatever that may be. Is that fair?
That's fair. I don't agree with you on everything, but if we were to break the UFO field into lifeboats, I think I'd be in yours.
Well, that's good to know. Here, let me turn you up just a little bit. Okay, you know what? I was looking at Blurry Lines, and there was a story in there about how long you'd been interested in UFOs, and you read all the books in the library. It sounds exactly like what happened to me. Did you have a weird sighting, or is it just kind of there at the beginning, the interest?
It was. It probably came more from the television shows, you know, some media exposure, and a little later on, though, I did see. I had an IFO sighting. I saw this, this bright object moving across the sky, and was really disappointed when the sun hit the tail fins and I saw it was just an airplane. But, you know, for a moment there, you know, it was magical.
Yeah. Oh, that's happened to me too a couple of times on different occasions where I thought, oh my God, this is great. And then I kind of come to find out that it's not as wonderfully magical as I thought it was. I've had that happen more than once. So, yeah. So nothing, yeah, because usually people come on and say, well, I had the sighting, and, you know. But for you and I think it's just we saw this stuff and at a young age and became fascinated by it.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something that I haven't talked about before. When I was a kid, probably, you know, I can pin it down from the show I was watching. I was watching the Lone Ranger cartoon by myself in my parents' living room. Everyone else was asleep. And I saw a spectral figure. It looked like it was made up of, looked like, kind of like cigarette smoke. Real wispy, didn't have a clear form. And, they say that our reactions are fight or flight. No, a lot of times we freeze, and that's what I did. And I stayed there and refused to look at it for what, you know, until the show was over, you know, and finally it was gone. But, you know, I could see it from the corner of my eye. And, of course, no one believed me. You know, and as a kid, I'd seen shadows and things that were scary, but this was, you know, and I don't know what it was. I don't say it was a ghost, or a being or anything. I don't know what it was. But, you know, so I know a little bit about what it's like to have seen something you can't explain and not to have people believe you. So, you know, I can empathize with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I never really had that. I've seen things that are so far away. You know, I was in Death Valley once. I saw a really bright light that was brighter than a star that just hung basically over the Nevada test site. I think that's where it was. I couldn't judge distances. And then when I was at Burning Man one year in 1995, I saw a bunch of lights moving in so far away I couldn't tell what they were, but they were moving in perpendicular lines, two or three lights. It was like they're on an Etch-a-Sketch and just slowly going up and down, then left and right, but always turning at 90-degree angles. So I don't know what that was. I mean, it could have been helicopters. I have no idea, but they're very exacting in the way they were moving. But they're so far away, I couldn't tell what they were.
Yeah. And you know, some of the best early sightings were indistinct like that, but the movement was uncharacteristic of airplanes. And so, I don't know. It's real confusing to me because some of the best stories are about indistinct things, and some of the worst stories are about distinct things.
Yeah, and some of them turn into Shaggy Dog stories. But
that's true.
But are you fascinated by the ones that are unknown and try and, you know, the puzzle of trying to figure out what they might be? Because there's quite a few of those.
There are. And, you know, it's frustrating a lot of times because the lack of details or just, you know, that you can't get a grip on anything that you can verify. A lot of times there's witness testimony and we know that that's bad. You know, you just can't, you know, not that people mean to be dishonest. They're just, you know, terrible at recounting details accurately. Yeah. And it gets worse.
Yeah.
Every person that's passed through.
Right. Yeah. Like the telephone game.
Exactly. And see, that's, you know, to introduce the Cash Lanham case, I think that's very much what's happened. You know, just, they say that details begin to blur just when a person tells their own story. And then when a second person repeats it, especially if they're biased in any way, that, and I think especially if someone is emotional about a situation, they may express things, you know, somebody was a mile away or, you know, whatever, you know, they talk in extremes. And if someone literalizes that, it just takes it a step further and further from the truth.
Yeah, whatever that might be. I had my sister-in-law, actually, Courtney, write me and said, you know, my boyfriend and I don't really know about the Cash Lanham case. Can you sort of explain it when you're on the show? And I talked to Kurt about this beforehand, and I will give, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I will give a real short version of the Cash Lanham case. It happened, what was the date? December what?
1980.
Yeah, December 29th, 1980. Three people were driving in a car, Vicky Cash and Betty Landrum and Colby Landrum.
Wait, we're going to stop you right there. You get the names backwards.
Oh, Vicky, go ahead.
Betty Cash.
Betty Cash and Vicky Landrum, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
They're driving home in East Texas, I believe, or West Texas.
East.
See, I don't know anything anymore. I will give the legendary story. They saw a light and then, or they came around, they came down the road and they saw this thing hovering over the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
And according to the traditional story, it was hovering over a road, and every time it got close to the road, as it would drop towards the road, it would shoot flames out the bottom. Vicky Landrum, Betty Cash got out of the car. They stopped the car and looked at it. Vicky Landrum got out of the car to look at it, and it was so hot that she had to get back in the car, and it was so hot she said that she couldn't open the car handle door when she was getting back in. She had to use her leather jacket. This went on for I don't know how long, probably no more than a couple of minutes, and then they said that they suddenly were aware that there were a bunch of Army helicopters around, those double rotor kind, which most people refer to as the Chinook-type helicopters. They said they counted 23 of them, and the thing apparently stopped shooting flames and floated away, surrounded by these helicopters. That is the gist of the case. And if I got anything else wrong, I'm sorry.
No, that's good, and you managed to tell the basic story without a lot of the sensational elements that have gotten later attached. So
that's what I tried to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
So what did you find? Why were you interested in the case in the first place?
I was a fan of Jim Moseley and wrote letters, and he called me back, and we started talking, and I offered unsolicited information on cases and more things than he could use, and he finally asked, hey, there's something you could research for me on the Cash Lanham case. He was trying to get a hold of some information about a pilot. It was kind of a legendary story. So I tracked that down, and just in case of looking at that information, you know, I came across the fact that the reputation of the case, that it was one of the most thoroughly investigated cases, and there seemed to be just a number of verifiable details, things that you should be able to grab hold of and track to a source one way or the other. So it just, and I had a prior interest in the military involvement in UFO cases, including the theory that some UFOs are caused by military projects. So, you know, it kind of clicked with a set of pre-existing ideas that I was looking into.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
When was this?
This would have been 2011.
Okay.
And so, you know, I've been really following things, and it, and there's a number of things about the case. You know, unlike Roswell, they're living witnesses. There are, you know, if the military was involved, there have to be personnel that not only there were a huge number of people that hadn't been involved in the flight of the helicopters, but then also the support crew. So there's, you know, even if they're bound by secrecy, those guys would be nearing retirement age, so there should be some potential leaks. You know, there's a possibility for some breaks in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was another thing. It's I consider it a live case, and you know, sure, it's, you know, there's been some years, but I started trying to just track down the information, and I found that some of the things that were said about the case didn't really match. And I finally got a hold of John Schuessler's book after having read most of it, the MUFON articles and quite a number of the newspaper articles. And I just felt like there was a layer of wishful thinking applied to the story and selective interpretation. And apparently some omission of details that were unfavorable to the story.
What did you find out first to lead you in that direction? And maybe we can get specific with some of them. Like maybe even you can even do it in a timeline way. Like, well, the first thing they saw was, you know, this thing floating over the road. Well, I guess we've established there's something floating over the road. But then I think after that, things began to diverge a bit.
Okay, well, let's... we'll probably have to jump around some, but
that's fine.
So first they see the object moving through the trees. When they get closer, they see this bright object, and you know, it's in the initial reports, there was a statement taken at the hospital. Well, I guess first we should say after the incident, they had agreed not to talk about it, and because they thought it was weird. Now, they thought that this might be particularly Vicki Landrum. It might be a supernatural event, particularly, you know, something to do with the return of Jesus, and she was trying to reassure the boy Colby that's what was happening, and it's hard to know exactly when they changed their mind, but it seems to have been when the helicopters came in, and. So we don't know if that's their bias against, because they didn't believe in UFOs or life on other planets or things like that. So we have to wonder if that was a valid interpretation. But because they saw the helicopters, they became convinced it was a military operation And I don't know if that was a split-second thing or if they processed on the drive home or the weeks that followed, but, you know, somewhere along the line that came up. So the object itself, though, the initial description was that it was so bright that they couldn't clearly make out a shape. They couldn't tell what it was. But from the beginning, Colby said that he thought it was diamond-shaped, but that was the only characteristic. And he was watching from inside the car through the windshield, you know, peeping over the windshield, basically, and hid his face most of the time on the drive home. And, you know, it was a very frightening experience. And they said, oh, strange thing is they said that when the helicopters came along, that was even more frightening, the noise and the movement and everything. It was, you know, very confusing.
Yeah.
So the description in the UFO literature of the diamond shape, and then later it was said to have had blue lights on it, is just not at all what the witnesses originally described.
Who did they describe the original? You know, most people think that John Schussler from MUFON, most famously, was the first person to talk to them, but he wasn't.
That's right. First, they called Vicki Landrum got the number for the National UFO Reporting Center, and Robert Gribble manned the phone, and there's a recording of that call, and she is, you know, excited and kind of breathless and rushes through the story, and he doesn't ask for a lot of specific details, but, you know, the basics are there. They're in the car. They see something. Her friend is hurt. She's in the hospital, and you know, says that the object is bigger than a car, but there's no, you know, there's not many specifics. From there, the report went to APRO, and there was apparently a rogue member there and intercepted the case. And back in these days, UFO organizations were working closely with particularly the National Enquirer, but other, you know, some other tabloids.
Yeah.
He sold the story to the Weekly World News, which at that time was not the freakish one that, you know, that had alien stories on every cover. They were more like just the general celebrity, you know, and sensational, but not, you know, outlandish and fabricated. So, you know, it's a matter of degree, but I mean, you know, there's they weren't into the full baloney mode yet.
Yeah.
And so the reporter, Dick Donovan, and this is unclear whether he personally investigated the case. I don't think that he traveled to Dayton to talk to him. I think that it was done over the phone and a recording was sent to him, and he probably contracted a local photographer to go out and then photograph the witnesses. But the first real coverage was from a tabloid newspaper, and they get the basic story, and it's fairly close to what was the basics of what are known later. And that's one of the things that are confusing about this story, as there are different versions. If you've heard one version and you hear the other one, it's sometimes like hearing a different version of the song. If they skip a verse, you may not notice it unless you're really familiar with it, because you know there's. So that's where the case really got out, and about that time, and this is before John Schussler was involved, and APRO got wind of the fact that the story had been sold, and they're based in Tucson, so I don't think they had the manpower to handle a case in the Houston area, so they turned it over to a group called Project Visit, which was led by John Schussler, and APRO and MUFON were bitter rivals.
Yeah, to say the least.
But I guess since John Schussler was deputy director of MUFON, but maybe because he had the separate group Visit, which was mainly fellow NASA contractors, you know, aerospace engineers, you know, maybe that softened the blow, and it was hard for him to accept. So he started investigating the case, and began by a phone interview with Betty Cash, and then met her, and saw the extent of her injury. She'd been out of the hospital a few weeks. But I guess one thing that I've kind of skipped in our sequence of events, she went into the hospital. I think it was December the 3rd, January 3rd or 4th, and was in and out for almost a month. I think she stayed 2 weeks, was out for a few days, and went back almost for another 2 weeks. So she was, and once she got out, several weeks had passed. He didn't come into the case until February the 22nd. So, you know, quite a bit of time, well, many weeks had passed, almost 2 months from the time of the incident before it started really getting investigated.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking a breath here and letting you digest, and hopefully you can ask a question.
Oh, no, I'm perfectly prepared when anybody comes on to let them go on at length. So what we see here is a slight divergence of what's going on, and it sounds like that the witnesses were telling the story, but it was changing a bit in their telling before they had really any influence, I guess. I don't know. As soon as somebody starts asking you questions, it's going to influence how you recall things, because there's going to be cues in what they say, and maybe you want to tell them what they want to hear because you want their help or something like that.
I think that's definitely a possibility, and especially when they made calls to the media, and they weren't getting the help they wanted. For one thing, the medical bills for Betty Cash were mounting. And while she was in the hospital, which the medical, we need to talk about the medical condition, but I think we'll come back to that. But
okay.
They're not getting help. And when they do get help, it's from John Schuessler, who works for NASA. Now, actually, he worked for McDonnell Douglas and contracted to NASA, you know, but that's a distinction most people aren't really going to make. And so,
right.
So if you're in Dayton, Texas, and all of a sudden a guy from NASA comes and he's on your case, I mean, you've got to really be impressed. And so I just think that, you know, just like when, ladies from their generation, an authority figure like that, they would probably kind of bend to his wishes and try to please him, cooperate. So I think the possibility of them being swayed is probably pretty high. And so as things got reported, you know, if you're with a group of people, and even if it's a child, you saw something you couldn't really define, and maybe the kid says it was diamond shaped. Well, that's a better explanation than you've got, and there's no evidence to the contrary. So, you know, maybe he could see it better. So it becomes officially diamond shaped somehow.
What did they originally say the shape was? They didn't know, or
didn't know, because it was the light itself was so bright that they couldn't determine. Well, it's very confusing, because it's hard to separate their description of the object from the light that it produced. And in one early account, Vicki Land describes it as a half a mile wide, and she must mean the light and not the object.
Right.
The object was the size is very note. When a newspaper article interviewed the two ladies, and now I'm forgetting which one said which, but because I think one was by phone and one was in person, but one of them said it was 15 feet wide and you know, maybe two or three times as long, and the other one, you know, said it was 30 feet wide and maybe, you know, so they're really kind of guessing. You know, we don't have firm measurements on that. Let me see. I'm going to try to take this in sequence a little bit more.
Okay, so, sure. No, you take your time. It's fine.
Betty Cash, her mother had come from Alabama, and right after a few days after the interview with John Schuessler, she goes back to Alabama and lives there for the rest of her life. This is something that really hasn't been stressed much in reviews of the case. John Schuessler was a full-time employee in NASA. He was working on the space shuttle program. He's a family man. He's a busy guy. But here's a red-hot UFO case that's basically on his doorstep. You know, he lives in Houston. Dayton's a short drive away. Mm-hmm. His interview with Betty Cash is on the 22nd, and it was a full week before he went to see Vicki Landrum. He didn't know what we know now. But, you know, for me, I think I would have gone that same day, you know. It just seems like for the information at hand, I just can't see waiting a week. But, you know, life happens, so maybe that was just the way it had to be handled. At any rate, he interviews, Colby Landrum was, Vicky's grandson. She had legal custody of him and he lived with her. And, they'd gone to play, bingo that night. I think Vicky was a regular bingo player. And I guess it's okay to take your kids to bingo games in Texas. And she had invited, Betty to go along that night. And apparently it was her first time, which was turned out to be a bad choice. So, Alan Holt, who's another member of, Project Visit, and he's very interesting, in UFO history. He's an astrophysicist and has a lot of theories about, interstellar drive and propulsion. And he's, you know, also a UFO, proponent. I started to say believer, but, you know, that's kind of a charged word.
Yeah.
They interview, both witnesses, separately and together. They get a sketch of, I'm not sure if it was in, but at some point they get a sketch of the UFO that the two of them put together, and they visit the scene. And so Betty Cash did not participate in the first visit to the scene. Despite what you saw, the reenactment, if you saw the Unsolved Mysteries, I think that was in 1991, mm-hmm. you know, where they had a, you know, I guess we'll call that a composite reenactment. But they go to the scene, the stretch of the road, and they pace off the distance that the UFO was estimated, and, you know, they take some photographs. And during this time, I forgot this, John Schuessler had previously examined Betty Cash's car with a Geiger counter. It didn't reveal anything. And there were handprints left from the encounter on the dashboard where Vicky Landrum had, it's not really clear. I think, you know, a lot of times when things happen fast and you're excited, you try to rationalize what happened. I don't think they really know when she put her handprints in the dash, whether it was when the car stopped or during the sighting, but, you know, it said that the automobile was heated from the presence of the UFO. They're not really good pictures of the dashboard, but it seems to be more like it's not like a handprint cement. It's not like that. It's more like it was dented from the pressure of hands. So that was one thing that, but the ladies always talked about the handprints as if it was terribly significant, and I'm not sure that it is, but, you know, there's been some discussion whether or not photographs were ever taken. They were filmed in a documentary, and John Schuessler had pictures of it in his book. That's just one little piece of potential physical evidence. But there wasn't too much else about the car that seemed strange. It wasn't hot from radioactivity, and when he checked the road, apparently nothing turned up there either. And
despite the fact that he later said that there was a repair on the road within a day or two of the incident, I think you discussed that on your site too.
Yeah, that's the real troubling claim. And I mentioned the Unsolved Mysteries earlier. It was really about in 1982 where the story about the road started coming up. And the initially in his first report on the case, which was in September of 1981 at a Center for UFO Studies conference, he describes what I just told you about the visit to the road, and he doesn't make any characterizations about it. He just says they paced off the distance. But as time passes, he says that both witnesses pinpointed the exact location, and that there was a burnt place on the road where the center lane was swirled, and it was, you know, apparently from the flames of the UFO. And then there's the story about the road being repaved. There's several things that relate to that. Later, when the witnesses, after some of the publicity, they had contacted the Center for UFO Studies, the member Alan Hendry, who was a Dr. Hynek's protege. He was contracted by the Fund for UFO Research to investigate the helicopters, and he went beyond his charter or orders, and to get all the background information, interviewed the witnesses personally, and one of the things he said in his report, and this is a combination of having seen the original report and talking to the witnesses, he said that examination of the road showed no burns, and this was in April 1981. In his conversations with him, and Dr. Hynek, I don't know if he directly talked to the witnesses, but he expressed the opinion, and Alan Hendry shared this, that they should contact their local senators and representatives and see if they could get some state help.
Yeah.
So the senators suggested they meet with officials at Bergstrom Air Force Base, and that's in Austin, which was, I'm not sure the mileage, but we'll say 180 miles from Houston. So Betty Cash had to come back from, I think she flew from Alabama to Houston, and then got together with Vicki and Colby. They drove to Austin. They met with officers of Bergstrom Air Force Base. So I think they had a two-hour interview, and there's a transcript of that available, and it's really some of the best independent information where you can hear what the witnesses actually had to say about things for themselves. And there's a few facts that are kind of out of whack in that testimony. One is, and this is one I think is some emotional exaggeration, in trying to plead her case, Betty Cash claims that she could see Air Force markings on the helicopters, and I just don't think that was literally true. I think she may have been overstating her case just out of desperation. Well, it was wrong, but I don't see that as a serious strike against her credibility.
Yeah.
Well, there are a number of things, interesting things about that interview, but that to fit in, I'm really taking the long way to get there. While they were in Austin, they also went to that's a state capital, so they went to see Representative Browder. He was out of the office, but the aide took the paperwork, and they turned the case over to the Texas Department of Health. That's where the good stuff about the case comes in. Hmm. They sent out a crew. Well, first of all, Charles R. Meyer called Vicki Landrum to get information. She gave him a short version of the story, and John Schuessler, in an interview, he was quoted as saying he became kind of a rabbi for the witnesses. He became, you know, to guide them and advise them, protect them. She recommended that he speak with John Schuessler for more technical details on the case. So, Meyer and his two other men from the Texas Department of Health's Radiation Control Bureau met with John Schuessler, got a detailed account of the story, including some of the doctors' names, some of the things that they'd said. And the interesting thing was he said that due to the fact it was dark and the emotional state of the witnesses, they could not pinpoint the location. And so this is, you know, this was in an official Texas document that didn't have any reason to exaggerate or misrepresent anything. And it appears to be an honest recounting of a conversation. And it's completely at odds with the UFO legend later about both witnesses pinpointing the location and a clear mark being on the road. If all those factors were there, he should have been able to point that out to the officials so that they can investigate it. I mean, this was an investigation that was made on behalf of the witnesses. So there's every reason to cooperate and produce that evidence if it was genuine.
By an official body, meaning the Texas Department of Health, you said, right?
Right. So without the information, without the location pinpointed, they were forced to drive up and down the road with a Geiger counter looking for general, you know, any general trace of radioactivity. They found none. They stopped at several places, you know, randomly, I suppose, to do more thorough checks, and then using the most likely locations they could find based on the description they had, which the only description they had was between a beer joint and a highway warning sign. you know, the road is, there was a stretch of road that was deserted, but it was not complete. You know, it's always presented as being a deserted road.
Yeah.
And it was sparsely populated. And even close to the siding area, there were a couple of mobile homes, trailers.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
And suppose, and well, this mostly comes up from sketchy details. See, the original report by Project Visit is not in the public domain for whatever reason. And other groups at the time had it. So somebody should still have it. QFOS had it, APRO had it, and I would think the Fund for UFO Research. But APRO wrote up a really detailed summary, and they mentioned the fact that someone that lived in one of those trailers had gone to bed at, say, like 8 o'clock, and that the incident was closer to 9, and that they didn't hear or see anything. Well, supposedly there was this fleet of helicopters, and so it's just very strange that they didn't wake up from this.
Yeah, well, as soon as you say that, people are going to say, well, we've got two witnesses that repeated it over and over, so how could that person be credible that we don't even know the identity of and that slept through this, which I guess some people can sleep through this kind of noise, but not out in the middle of the country.
Sure, and, you know, we know nothing about them. What if they'd, you know, downed two bottles of Jack Daniels? We just don't know, you know, the nature of that sleep. So, I mean, that's a sketchy detail, but supposedly in the investigation that followed, everyone within every resident within a 5-mile area or 5 or 10 mile area was questioned, and I don't think they didn't really turn anything up at that time. So the claim of a definite spot on the road seems to be grossly inaccurate, and it seems to go beyond just an exaggeration or a mischaracterization, and I don't know what else to say about that, but that's the foundation of some of the story of the case, including the fact that it was repaved shortly thereafter. And you know, I already said that it was almost 2 months before the examination of that scene was made. And at the time, it wasn't done in the first 2 months. And the first mention of it seems to come from APRO, where they say that it, and I don't know how they heard of it. There was an angry exchange of letters because APRO felt like they were being shut out of the case and not receiving information on the medical records, which we'll need to come back to. And they had questions and criticisms of the case, and they had a gripe with MUFON anyway. So in the exchange of letters, John Schuessler took one of their APRO articles where they mentioned the road, and he said, who resurfaced the road? When did it happen? You know, this was in 1982, and he was just hearing about it for the first time.
Oh, okay.
In an article by Billy Cox, who was reporting on UFOs in as early as 1983 and still has a column about it today, a Devoid, that's online. I think it's with I don't want to say the name. I'll get it wrong. But
Billy Cox, the radio guy? Did he not have like a proto UFO, like Art Bell type show in the 1980s or 90s?
I have no knowledge of that. I know him as a reporter and a columnist. So
okay.
In his story, and he wrote an excellent 3-part story on the case and talked to people that no one else had found and really did great coverage on it. But you know, he went to, you know, from Florida to, you know, not many people, you know, there's a lot of research by phone, but he actually went there, interviewed and photographed things. He reported that one lane of the road had been repaired. The story of and I asked him about this by email, and he said that he didn't see any evidence of any covert repairs. I think he mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned the address of the site, because all my mistakes I will address and correct there, as I will probably misspeak a few times. But I believe that he said that he saw repairs being done. It didn't appear to be covert, and it was just the one lane. So the story about the overnight repair appears to be false. I believe that to be probably just routine repairs, and it happened to be in the area, and a connection was made that was not genuine, and it became a legend.
Oh, okay.
And it just became folklore that was attached to the case. There's nothing solid. Now, the thing is that Vicki Landrum believed it when, this is skipping ahead again, but, Chris Lambright became interested in the case because he intended to do a series of paintings based on UFO cases and get the details as accurately as possible and talking to the witnesses. So he went to Dayton and interviewed Vicki Landrum for this purpose. And in that conversation, he got details on a number of things, and she told him about the road, and she firmly believed it, but it was all hearsay. And, you know, I think that when you're presented with information that supports your case, you're not always as critical of it as you would be if it was either neutral or definitely if it was in opposition. So she was inclined to believe it.
Right. So what we have here is that the stories start to diverge, and it seems like the ones that are more sensationalized, or I don't know what you want to call it, are the ones that seem to stick. And the original story, can anybody see the transcript of that call to the UFO Reporting Center? Is that who they called?
Luckily, Robert Gribble released tapes to Wendy Connors.
Ah.
And she broadcast on an episode of Strange Days Indeed. And we got a record, and she didn't put it on one of her faded discs, but we pulled it from that. And so we do have a recording, and it's apparently edited out the contact details out. Didn't give addresses and phone numbers, but the content of the call is, and I've got, in fact, I made a little YouTube video of that with pictures of the case. So the call is preserved, and also made a transcript of it. And she, there are a few, there were a few words that were really difficult to make out. She says something like, she tried to call him Colby so he wouldn't have, and it's difficult to tell if she said heart failure or hysteria. But, you know, it's, yeah, that exists. And so we do have that recording, and you probably were going to ask about something else, too.
Well, I've got like three or four different questions about the case. Another one is Vicki Landrum, especially, I believe, had more exposure to whatever this was, and she was the one that was in and out of the hospital, right?
Yeah, that was Betty. Now, Vicki's symptoms were in phone. Well, that's interesting. We were just talking about the phone call. In the phone call, she said all that happened to her were that her eyes were burned, and that call was made February 2nd, and so all, you know, 20 days before John Schuster was involved. Yeah, Betty Cash was the one with the serious injuries.
Right, I'm sorry.
What were you going to ask about the injuries?
Most people assume, because of the way the story has gone and the way that people have retold it, is that she was affected by some sort of radiation. Now, there's different types of radiation. There's, you know, radioactive radiation and ionizing radiation and all this. But most people think it's some sort of, you know, radiation in the term that most people think of it, which is atomic radiation. On your site and in a couple articles, you say that no symptoms of actual radiation poisoning were ever found on her, although she did have, you know, she lost some hair, and I guess there were, the original medical report said she had like blisters and things like that. Has anybody ever been able to figure out what would have caused that?
That's a puzzle, but the gist of it is that in her blood test, there were nothing showed up. There were no irregularities. You know, that she had these symptoms, but the test didn't indicate radiation. You were asking about traces.
Well, I was asking
verifiable
about
traces.
No, what I was asking about was the health problems associated with whatever happened to these women, which was you know, visited on one of them quite a bit more than the other, and there have been pictures of Betty Cash, right?
That's right.
With her hair falling out, and I don't know if that was a, you know, is that a direct result of their encounter? And there's also the question of, you know, well, she did go to the hospital. She did have, like you said, health effects. Now, either she got the health effects from their sighting or something happened to her later, one of the two. And unless they're horribly lying, I think I would probably err on the side of something during the encounter caused a lot of these health problems or exacerbated something that happened before. I don't know which.
You mentioned to me when you wrote Project Beta that you did it sequentially like it was a spy story. If we were doing the Cash Landrum story, if it were a movie, the fairest way to depict the story is probably the night Betty Cash was homesick and then went into the hospital, and then you kind of do some time compression, and then there's a moment where she's in the hospital for the second time, the doctor's saying, well, I don't understand what's wrong with you. And then Colby says, I know what it was. It was that thing that we saw. That's what hurt her.
Uh-huh.
So that, and then you would have the witnesses tell their story and from their point of view, and you wouldn't show it as as it actually necessarily happened. You'd hear their version of it.
Right.
So that would be the fairest way to depict it. So, but while she was in the hospital, her early symptoms, I can just tell you about those. Initially it was a headache, and this is something that's kind of skipped over. She had continued to have terrible headaches, and that was her worst complaint, and that's what was crippling pain. But along with that, she had these knots. They said it was, at one point, I don't know if it was literally golf ball size, but you know, I'm sure that's what it felt like. These kind of boils on her body in several places, on her back, and she had one blister over her eye that was big. Her ears swole up such that, you know, they had to, I guess she still had her earrings in, they had to, you know, pull the earrings off so it wouldn't split the skin. And when her daughter, who lived in another city in Texas, came to visit it, she looked in the room and she thought she was in the wrong room, but her mother's face was so swollen she didn't recognize her.
How long after the incident was this?
It was 3 days. I tend to believe something really happened. I think there was a genuine experience, but I think there's some contradictions in the story. There's some puzzling things. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible there are points where the witness exaggerated, and there's no doubt that there are times when the UFO reporting of it was exaggerated. But the next day, supposedly, all of them were suffering various effects, diarrhea and a sunburn-like condition on the skin. You know, that was the chief symptoms of Colby and Vicky.
Yeah,
they were going to help Betty move her. She had a truck stop with a little grocery store. She was. It's really unclear whether the business had already been closed. It's been reported that it was being moved, but for whatever reason, it was being moved. They met with Colby went. He was supposed to help, despite them being sick, and Betty didn't show. And eventually, Vicky says, sends Colby for the, whatever it is, like a half-mile walk in the relatively mild Texas winter to go to Betty's house to check on her. So he goes, he peeps in the window, sees her there sick in the bed and fairly unresponsive, and that's how they found out she was sick and eventually took her to Vicky's home for a few days. Well, the part of the story that just doesn't fly to me is, if Vicky and Colby were that sick, why they went to try to help somebody pack and move, and secondly, why do you send a sick child who's having symptoms of diarrhea on a walk by himself for half a mile? That's something I just have to wonder if there's not a slight exaggeration of their symptoms to make it sync better with the genuine, absolutely genuine problems of Betty. And that's a possibility and has to be considered. So I'm not making a judgment there. So Betty is really unable to eat or drink very well. She's throwing up, and it's so it's about 3 days before they're able to get her into the hospital. And she had previously had heart problems. She had open heart surgery. It was about 2 years before, and mm-hmm. she had that surgery in Alabama. She was seeing a local cardiologist, V.B. Chenoy, and he was the one that met her in the hospital, and it was to this doctor that they first told the UFO story. And just to cite another puzzling element of the case, I can't understand why they decided to keep things secret if they thought it was a military project. Now, if it was a UFO and they just thought they'd be ridiculed, which is apparently the excuse for keeping it secret. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. I can understand them wanting to keep it secret if it was a UFO, but since they thought it was a military project, why would they fear being ridiculed to describe it?
Well, how long did they fear being ridiculed? Who did they tell about it? How long was it before they told anybody what was going on? Apparently they told this doctor, the cardiologist.
Right. The first hospital visit was went in about January 3rd, and she was in for 2 weeks. So it would have been, you know, sometime in the middle of January when she went back in for her after being released and not really having any relief and having a kind of relapse of symptoms, particularly the headaches. Oh, and at that time, I think that's when the hair loss really began, although in Betty's retelling of the story, sometimes she says in several places that her hair started falling out that very night, which makes it a very bad match for radiation poisoning, because that's supposed to happen. You know, it fits better with radiation poisoning if it is with that second visit. That's when they told. So that was from December 29th to middle of January, you know, more than 2 weeks. So that's when the story broke. They took some hair samples for heavy metal poisoning, and apparently there was a problem with that, and it I'm not sure if the test failed or it was inconclusive, but none of the hospital tests showed exposure to ionizing radiation. Just the combination of symptoms with the skin problems and the hair loss, you know, definitely it seemed to match radiation. Well, it was similar to it. And that similarity, I think, has been overemphasized. Some of the puzzling thing, if the object produced radiation, what kind of radiation? You know, was it non-ionizing? Was it microwave? In John Schuessler's analysis, you know, this is one thing that I thought, you know, that he was definitely scientifically accurate about. He said that no one type of radiation would match all the symptoms. So if it was an atomic-powered ship, it had to be shooting off other, you know, whether it was extraterrestrial or a secret government experiment, it basically had to be producing a cocktail of radiation,
right,
in order to produce the symptoms. And Phil Klass, the legendary demon debunker, he said that he just didn't believe that the difference in shielding from being inside and outside an automobile would account for the difference of the injuries, with Betty Cash's being so much more extreme. It was his belief that the story was built around Betty's injuries, and it was in order to get the government to pay for her medical bills. And so he just flatly declared it a hoax. And he...
By making a ton of assumptions and ignoring a ton of evidence and witness testimony, as usual.
And he cited his chief supporting evidence was the fact that the helicopters could never be found.
Well, they could be totally out and out lying, but...
It seems unlikely.
Yeah, there's too much internal consistency, at least to parts of the story. And like you said, I think something happened. I don't know what it is or what they saw, but I think something happened. But we'll get into that in a little bit.
Well, just to examine, you know, since the charge of hoax has been mentioned, I just wanted to say that there is no absolute concrete evidence to prove this case.
Right.
The behavior of the witnesses is very convincing. I mean, a lot of intelligent people, reporters, scientists, you know, even non-ufologists, and even by the way, there are some skeptics, notable skeptics, Tim Prenti and Jim Oberg, both believe that there was a genuine event,
right.
And they don't, and that something happened, and you know, it's unexplained. Now they probably think that it was, you know. There's even not from them, but some skeptics say that it was a helicopter that snagged a power line, it arced, and it caused some of these symptoms. You know, it's probably not that simple, but you know, so even you know the skeptics are not united in saying that this case is a hoax. You know, there's some allowance for the believing the witnesses. You know, that maybe something was misperceived, but it was a genuine event, and. To argue against a hoax, I just want to say that it is inconsistent to me that they would be such good actors and such poor capitalists. You know, they it's true that they sued the government, but they didn't go in the UFO lecture. They didn't have books, and you know, they did make some television appearances, but these are not.
Yeah, they make a living off it.
No, this is not the George Adamski or the Daniel Fry kind of thing. And these the people that tend to hoax, first of all, they tell better stories. You know, their story's like a hit-and-run story, and they don't even play a central role. They saw something weird. They don't know what it was. They got sick. That's, you know, typically the hoaxers also, they give themselves away by being too egotistical. They star in the story. They play a central role. Something came across space just to visit them. And then once they tell their story and interest fades, it usually comes back. They see it again. They receive another message. They continue to be center in this ongoing storyline. And that's not what happened here.
Yeah.
And they just basically stuck to their story until both ladies died. I mean, it doesn't fit the human profile of a faker at all.
Yeah. Well, there is one living witness left, and that's Colby Landerman. He has begun to talk a little bit to various people. Is he kind of still genuinely puzzled about what went on? Because he refused to talk about it for many years.
That's right. In fact, when I was looking into the case, I was looking at every resource that I could, including some of the local message boards in Texas. And there was someone that said, "Hey, what about this guy y'all went to school with that saw the UFO?" And he said, "He doesn't talk about that. He never has. And it's, you know." It's a touchy subject. Now, apparently, he had a lot of anger in association with, you know, he did have some people that teased him about it. And so, yeah, he it was strictly off limits for a long time. You know, I've talked with him a little bit. He's got a daughter. I think he thinks that he owes it to his family, both living and dead, to represent the story.
Yeah.
So he's willing to talk about it some, but it's painful for him. He has a lot of negative feelings in association with this.
How old was he when this happened, and how old is he now?
I think he just turned 40. My math is kind of bad, but he was a month shy of 7 years old when it happened, and his memories kind of skip around. When I talked to him, I tried to get some details about movement and his impressions, but the encounter was, well, you know, he was hiding for part of it.
Yeah.
Truthfully, he was scared. And then there are other things. Well, I asked him about one of the things I've been trying to track down is some of the early television coverage. There was an interview on Good Morning America, and this would have, you know, been in early 1981, and most homes didn't have video recorders in. And later there was another program, That's Incredible, that featured it. And that, both of those really helped get the word out and, you know, became more of a mainstream case.
Yeah.
But so I was asking him about especially the Good Morning America show and what he remembered about it. And he said, well, I don't remember the interview at all, but I remember riding in a limousine and, you know, that my mom had told me to tug my ear while I was on camera to say hello. So, you know, he has memories, but they're not necessarily helpful to the case.
Yeah.
I know there are a lot of things from my childhood that I remember it's sort of, I don't remember the event, but I remember remembering them, and I remember talking about them, and they're kind of kept alive that way. I don't think he's ever undergone hypnosis, which is something that I want to go back to. In John Schuessler's investigation, I mentioned that that's an incredible show, and that's the National Enquirer, I mentioned already, had an association, a relationship with UFO investigators. Somehow, Dr. R. Leo Sprinkle was brought in, probably being paid for by either the television show or National Enquirer, and he hypnotized Vicki Landrum in July 7th, 1981. Schuessler, I think, really had some big plans, because one of the things that Dr. Sprinkle is associated with is abduction. So they wanted to check for some of the things, like in other UFO cases, like encounters with aliens, possible abduction and missing time. But under hypnosis, the story came out pretty much the same. There were a few things, you know, there were some maybe a little emotional, a little more emotional because, you know, she was reliving it. But there were a couple of details that came out for the first time. One was Vicki, it was almost like she was pantomiming. She said, I smell lighter fluid. Did I drop my lighter? You know, and, you know, she smoked, but she didn't have a lighter that had lighter fluid in it. Or, you know, she probably had like a Bic lighter that was sealed,
yeah,
something like that. So so speculation came up, you know, was, first of all, any information, and there were two things that came out in hypnosis that were new, was that this information was genuine. And, you know, we know from other cases, and UFO or not, that sometimes details can be fabricated. You know, why, I don't know, but reliving it, it just tends to drive the imagination. But
if you're using hypnosis for something everybody knows about, like a crime scene, you can say, you know, this person took this thing and dropped this thing and picked up this knife. But you're talking about something that nobody has, you know, not everybody has experience with. I think it's a little bit harder to guard against your mind trying to make sense out of things by adding things in or taking them out or whatever. So I've never thought that hypnosis, well, never, but I've come to think that hypnosis is not kind of a, you know, a truth serum. It really isn't, because the mind doesn't work that way. At least that's what I think.
This is the big one for me. Vicki was never hypnotized. And we have a letter where Dr. Sprinkle wanted to hypnotize Betty, but Schuessler said that she was too ill. So mm-hmm. It was only Vicki that was under hypnosis. She mentioned something about little blue lights, or, you know, something blue, and it comes little blue lights. And so on the basis of this, and something even stranger, the UFO suddenly develops a ring of blue lights or portholes around the center of the diamond. The other thing is, when Alan Holt and John Schuessler were visiting Vicki in Dayton, Colby Landrum was said to be, I guess we'll say he was traumatized by the event, and he was like in Close Encounters, where the guy sculpted in the potatoes.
Yeah.
He was continually drawing pictures of the UFO, and he couldn't get it right. Well, Vicki got him a Light Bright. You remember the Light Bright toy? They still make them, I think.
Yeah, I've seen the picture of the Light Bright he made.
Yeah, so he makes this, and the thing is, you mentioned Etch-a-Sketch earlier. With an Etch-a-Sketch, you can make gentle curves and everything else. Well, in a Light Bright, you're forced pretty much to make angular shapes. So he made a diamond. He had some little pegs up there to represent a helicopter. Well, it's colored pegs, and apparently some of the pegs he used in his illustration were blue. So that became corroboration for the blue lights in the hypnosis session. So in John Schuessler's illustration of the UFO, where originally they described it as this large, indistinct shape that was blinding, we got this metallic, almost like egg-like rounded diamond with this ring of blue lights on it. And it was, and the way it's depicted, especially in contrast to the helicopters in the picture, it looks like a giant, almost a Close Encounters type UFO. and it's just not at all what the ladies originally described. And we have an earlier sketch that one of the things I did with Colby, and of course, you know, so long after the fact, who can say that it's more accurate than anything else, but I asked him if there were blue lights, and he said no. And I showed him one of the earlier sketches that presented more of a featureless diamond, and he said, well, you know, that's in black and white, but that's very close to what I saw. Chris Lambright eventually did a couple of illustrations based on the witness testimony, because when I mentioned he interviewed Vicki Landrum, Colby was not there, and afterwards he called Betty Cash and interviewed her by phone and covered the same material, and I've got a copy of his handwritten notes from the interview, and he's jotting down what she says, and he says no blue lights. So that's some imaginary icing put on the cake, and it kind of does a few things. One is, you know, it's a, well, besides being a detail that's not there, it's a weird detail that sort of supports it being a extraterrestrial craft. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, I guess you could put blue lights on an Army project, but it doesn't sound like it.
Yeah.
So, to me, that's a crucial error, because you have the witness testimony, and then you have this image that's on the cover of his book, and it appeared in lectures, and then it went on when the case was depicted on all of the television programs. And, you know, the show Unsolved Mysteries was a primetime show, and, you know, anyone that remembers the case in the general public, and there's a few, you know, they'll maybe kind of dimly remember it. They saw this thing, and it's got this ring, you know, it's a rigid diamond shape with a flat bottom. Now, their special effects were terrible, and it has this little gust of fire coming out of it, but it's got these big circles of blue. Well, I don't think they're blue. I think they're actually white in the show, but they look more like portholes. And it just gets further and further away from what they saw, what they experienced. And why that's important is in our conversation about when we were kind of talking about things before the show, you mentioned the legal case.
Yeah.
And that's a whole big other topic. But I have to, you know, this is something I can find. This is when the case got shot down. They are leading up to it. This was actually in 1984. I think it was in 1985 when the nail was put in the coffin of the case. This is from Richard L. Ballard, acting chief of Aviation Systems Division. Shoot, I don't see what branch this is. Well, it's government anyway. He says he and other branches of the military were asked about the case. There were two things they were supposed to be looking for. One was the helicopters, and the other thing was, do you have an object like the plaintiffs say that injured them? And he says, I've compared the description of the object in Exhibit A with my knowledge of the inventory of all Army craft capable of flight. No such aircraft was owned, operated, or in the inventory of the United States Army on or about December 29, 1980. Further, I've never seen or heard of any such craft described as being associated with military service. So I think statements from him and from other branches of the military service, based on the diamond-shaped description, now I don't think the lights made it into this version, but they said, you know, it was made to sound like a UFO more so than a military project, and they said, okay, well, we don't have a weird diamond-shaped thing. So
yeah.
The fact that it was investigated by a UFO group and it was presented as a UFO event, even if they said that the object could have been military, but I think the fact that the UFO was in it tainted it, and it made it easier to dismiss. You know, I mentioned earlier I was interested in military cases where things might have been misinterpreted as UFOs. Another part of that is sometimes they've said that UFOs are used as cover stories for military projects, and the one that's cited the most often and has the most likelihood of being genuine is for the U-2 spy plane and for the Blackbird, and possibly even the stealth aircraft.
Yeah.
So if a UFO is ever used as cover for a military project, this would have to be, if that's the case, this would have to be the ultimate, because, you know, people got injured. That's a fascinating element. Oh, and about military secrecy, this happened during the Iran hostage, the American hostages held in Iran, and just yeah. right at the right.
I read this bit on your blog.
Yeah. So now that happened at the end of the Carter administration, and when Ronald Reagan came in. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself as usual, but there was a planned second rescue. There was a failed hostage rescue that involved helicopters. There was a second one, and there was extensive training. And, you know, our special forces operation was JSOC, whatever that stands for, Joint Strategic Operation Command, something like that. That was born out of the team that was put together to run this operation. And it was there were two helicopter groups that came out of this. One is now known as the Night Stalkers, and the other one was more secret, which or at least was at the time, called Sea Spray. And the mission was called off because when Reagan was elected, I don't know how, you know, there's all sorts of rumors and things, but the hostages were released shortly after that. So yeah. the mission, they stood down, but felt that they needed to keep that team together for other operations. And under Reagan, see, Carter had let some things slip about stealth, and we had all these secret things being developed, you know, the stealth, several different stealth planes and military projects. But under Reagan, they really clamped down the lid on military secrecy, and those groups I mentioned, particularly Sea Spray, they were just furiously determined to keep those secret. And if there was something, if it was a military operation, it may have been locked down in the secrecy from the early Reagan era that kept it from coming to light.
Yeah, well, what it sounds like, as you were describing it here and how the story changed and all that, and how the UFO investigators described it, it sounds like if the military had to admit something, they were kind of handed the story on a silver platter where they could deny something because it wasn't actually what was seen.
Yeah, and the evidence was so sketchy that there were a number of things that were just kind of unsupportable. And I wonder sometimes, and this has, you know, I have to consider possibilities. In John Schuessler became personally involved with the witnesses. You know, he said that he kind of had a role as a rabbi to him. And it crossed my mind that maybe he oversold some of the case with the intent of helping him, you know, making it sound like the case was stronger. And I wonder even, too, if the lawyer representing them, Peter Gersten, if there was an element of bluff in this with the legal case, and that they hoped that the government would settle, you know, that they just think, you know, instead of having some provable facts, they just had a stack of weak ones, you know, some that were circumstantial and, you know, more hearsay than anything else. But it didn't work. They filed a damage claim form to the Air Force, and that was denied, and then they filed a civil suit, and that was, it never went to court. You told me something interesting that you had heard that there was an offer to settle the case out of court. And I remembered that Chris Lambright videotaped his interview with Vicki Landrum. I read a copy of it. The sound is terrible, and it's almost unwatchable. But, you know, I concentrated and listened. One of the things that he asked her about is this was before the legal case was thrown out. He asked her what she wanted out of it. You know, would she accept a settlement? And she really seemed to be struggling with the answer. And she, so this is why I don't think the legal settlement was ever offered, because she says that, well, you know, she would like to have the money to be able to provide for Colby, you know, for whatever medical care he might need.
Yeah.
But she's adamant that she wants the government to admit responsibility. And, you know, there's times when she's talking about some things where you wonder how solid the information is. But this was not one of them. I mean, this is just, you know, I'm not an expert on body language and facial expressions, but I think I'm pretty good at it. And I just felt that this was one time in particular that stood out, that she was absolutely genuine and was sharing her, you know, pretty strong convictions about it, that she wanted the government to take responsibility. And that was another interesting thing. We were talking earlier about the characterization of the witnesses. They were concerned from the beginning in that this could happen to other people, and not only could they be injured by something like this, but that UFO witnesses could be, well, basically mistreated by the press, treated disrespectfully, that sort of thing. That, you know, that they, Betty Cash had even said on a number of occasions that she kind of laughed at UFO stories, and that after this happened to her, you know, she saw that, you know, well, I don't, you know, she didn't believe that it was extraterrestrial, but you know, she had empathy for other people. And there was one case in, I think it was 1989 in Alabama, where she got involved and was trying to give some support to people who had seen a UFO. So it seems like genuine concern and not showboating.
Yeah. Considering all this stuff, I mean, we've got half an hour and I wanted to talk about other things too. But, and you can ask me stuff if you want. But considering all that we've talked about and haven't talked about, actually, because we could talk about this for hours, what do you think, what's your best guess? What's your, like, working hypothesis right now about what they saw? Or do you have one?
Okay. First of all, I have a blank. And the blank is where the UFO is. I don't know what that is. So I'm only trying to consider this as a military. I'm really only concerned with the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think they were out there, and I think they saw something. Now, in that blank, I've considered a number of things. Like, did they get frightened by a helicopter spotlight? You know, is it something like that? There is, you know, was it something simple like that? But I can't answer that. And, you know, I have lots of candidates. I've gone through different military projects that the special forces were using. I've tried to see, you know, nothing's been declassified that's similar to this in any way. There have been some vertical takeoff and landing rockets that were developed before this that don't match. Some that were developed much later than this that don't match. But if you wanted to build something that did what this UFO supposedly did, it can be duplicated with 1980s technology. And the craft flew. You know, at one point I was considering, could this have been a hot air balloon? Because everything they describe about it, they said it hovered, it floated, it hung in the air, it drifted. You know, it didn't zip around, and it didn't have that typical UFO thing of, you know, faster than a jet and 90-degree turns and, you know, gravity-defying. It was, it almost seems like, you know, whatever it was is capable of balloon-like flight.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and that's probably a dead end, but it also kind of accounts for the massive size of it. Size of, supposed to be about the size of a water tower.
Yeah.
So, you know, a balloon gets you there, but it just, you know, not much else works.
Did you hear the interview I did with some guy that said he had worked for a military contractor in San Diego, I believe, probably 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, about some sort of neutral buoyancy aircraft? Basically would use, you know, lighter than air technology, but also with, you know, with ducted fans or something in it so that it could duplicate some of these UFO movements, and it could just use, you know, differential thrust and things like that to move, hover, you know, turn very quickly, all that stuff. It starts to sound a little like that if you believe that technology exists. And it's, you know, the technology sounds plausible to me.
Oh, well, here's another really bad match. Houston had a Goodyear blimp. operate there for several years. In fact, the other guy that where we have a good UFO sighting, he saw it about, I think, an hour before the witnesses did. And his story is kind of a problem for two reasons. One is it didn't surface until they got in the news asking for other witnesses to come forward. And that's the problem with all the other witnesses. None of them reported independently until, you know, they asked for help, you know, for other people to come forward. But he saw something. It was a triangular-shaped thing. It was big. It kind of had jet plumes. I think he saw some headlights. But when he first saw it, he thought he was seeing the Goodyear blimp. And it even kind of made a noise that made it, I mean, I don't know if he was that familiar with seeing it, but that was just kind of a weird connection. But the blimp has an alibi, so it wasn't the blimp. Oh, so how are we doing on time?
We got about, looks like we have about 25 minutes left.
Okay. Well, tell me where you want to go. I mean, I definitely want to kind of close with an uplifting message about, you know, the fact the case needs to be reopened, and I do think that there's a chance of finding something. So, and we can talk about anything else. And there's tons of details. I hope people will, you know, check the site.
Yeah.
You know, there's all sorts of things I meant to say and will remember, you know, 5 minutes after the show is over. There's something really weird that I think your show is probably the best thing to talk about. And if you want to, there was a note. Okay, first of all, there's the angle. They thought it was something supernatural originally.
Yeah.
In the notes that John, apparently this is the Army guy, Colonel Saran, when he was investigating for the DAIG, he's getting the story from Schuessler over the phone, and he's making these short little notes. So, to him and then a kid, and gets sick. And then there's one note that's like, all of a sudden, just like, work of the devil, get out of the city. What the hell? So it makes me wonder that, you know, at some point, did they think there was a curse or... And, you know, if you think about all the things...
Who wrote this note?
This would have been Colonel Saran doing the investigation for the Pentagon. He was a compulsive note taker. Before he came to Texas to investigate, he was getting background information from Schuessler. And one of the things this is another thing that's crazy. Schuessler gave him some information. Have you heard the thing about the 100 helicopters?
No, I haven't. And what's the relationship of the... Is he an Air Force guy, the colonel?
No, see, the Air Force... when he got on television, Ron Wyden, who I think is still a senator from, I don't know what state. Anyway, he made a complaint, and he said, hey, the Army needs to look into this, you know, or the Air Force, because they thought it was Air Force, because it's something that flew.
Yeah.
The Air Force said, we don't have the... CH-47s. Those are Army helicopters.
Right.
So the Army started looking into it. So from there, and this is, I don't know if you knew this or how widely this is known, John Alexander had worked for the Department of Army Inspector General. Now, I don't know if he had just left the job or was still there, but Saran called on him for background information, along with Dr. Peter Rank, who MUFON was using to investigate the radiation injuries.
Yeah.
Also, Dr. Richard Nimso, who was an ex-project visit partner of Schuessler, he was another UFO guy in the military that was consulted, and so was Dr. Paul Tyler, who was the buddy of Alexander's.
Uh-huh.
And what's weird about him is I think he was involved in, like, microwave radiation experiments. So, you know, at least in Alexander and Tyler's case, some of the guys that should have been building weird stuff like this that could make these injuries were the ones that were investigating. Now, I don't think there was a conspiracy there, but, you know, the people will talk. Well, I went off on another trivia tangent there. So why hasn't anyone said that this unexplainable light that caused this awesome experience and injuries that aren't explained, why couldn't it have been supernatural? You know, I'm not proposing or even supporting the fact that it is, but you know, why is that not a valid area of investigation?
Because it doesn't sound scientific, Kurt, damn it. And science is going to save us. We all know that. I'm only half joking here. It's if you listen to my show at all, you know that I have a great respect for science. I have a great respect for critical thought. But I also have a respect for the kind of things that people call whatever, the supernatural, the occult, or whatever, because I think it's not total junk. But it's not examinable or consistent with the scientific method the way it is now. The thing is, I think there's a validity to it, which is why I think, you know, it's a fun speculation that you bring up. And I have never heard anybody say that, why don't we just take this part of it seriously? I think it's a really nice idea.
Well, and getting into the flaky area, you know, Dr. Hynek was considering more of the valet kind of thing. I reprinted part of his article from Omni magazine where he talked about the case. He was stretching for a UFO explanation and was thinking about that some of them were holographic-like projections, yet they could make physical effects, leave ground traces, and in this case, injuries. And he thought that since the helicopters were unexplained, the UFO and the helicopters were some sort of, well, he didn't use the word interdimensional, but that's where he seemed to be talking about,
yeah,
that interference with our reality. And that's why the helicopters could never be found. And he took it as a fact that there were no physical helicopters in the case. So that's the fringier side of the case.
So it could be any one of a number of things, but what we're kind of left with, as far as you're concerned, and me too, even before I talk to you, is that something happened, but we're not exactly sure what yet.
But I don't think it's a complete dead end for a number of reasons. One is there's any government project that was involved, there's got to be some documentation. There's got to be surviving operators of the equipment. And I still think it's possible that, well, the most unlikely thing of all is for other witnesses to surface. But there were some disappearing witnesses, people who decided they didn't want to talk about it. And we can't be sure if they were ever really good because we don't have the documentation of their record. It's just like, you know, a couple of lines in a UFO report. There was the trio of people who were mentioned in the Weekly World News, and that information was shared with Alan Hendry, and he got their phone number. They were real people. Now, whether or not the information was solid about what they saw, they apparently decided they didn't want to talk about it. But if they saw the same UFO, they're the best leads to determine that this was real, because most of the other people, they said they saw some helicopters at the time, and sometimes they weren't even sure it was the same day, but they were kind of counted as supporting witnesses. So, you know, that was kind of I thought it was kind of like padding the witness count personally, but, you know, if we had a really good UFO sighting, that would tell us more about the thing and, you know, that it was a genuine event, because we're just left with a lot of smoke.
Have you gotten any negative comments from people about it? Like, why are you trying to debunk this case? And, you know,
well, not as much as I would expect, and especially since I'm critical of the investigation, and since John Schuster conducted that investigation, I don't want to implicate him so much as maybe the organization or the methodology, the methods that were used, even though MUFON, you know, is always strived that they're a scientific organization. I think bias can enter into it. You know, one of the things with the UFO case is Donald Kehoe's thing that UFOs are interplanetary spacecraft. The government knows about it. The government covers them up. They bring that baggage in a UFO investigation. It's like, so if you can't find evidence, that means it was covered up.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes it just didn't happen. So,
yeah.
And so when the government doesn't give you the answer you want, that doesn't mean it's a cover up. Not every time. So, and they do have other secrets that are real, but they just don't want to talk about. So, I think that can cloud the issue. But yes, there's been some of that, and you know, Robert Schaefer read some of our reports, and the title of his article was "Another Classic Case Crumbles." Well, okay, that's a little premature. You know, all I'm saying is there are serious problems with the way the case information is reported. We've got basically the wrong UFO. You know, we're chasing the wrong suspect, and the details about the road are wrong. But you know, it did happen on that road, and it did happen to these people. And there's no indication that the witnesses themselves are lying. You know, it's almost like, I guess if your house was robbed and you got a dirty cop at the scene and, you know, he steals some of your jewelry too, you know, you were still robbed. And, you know, I'm making a terrible example, but I think, you know.
I know what you're trying to say.
Yeah, so these people, I mean, they're at a disadvantage too, because there was no police report filed. They called a policeman. That it happened in a different city, and as it happens, a different county than where they lived. So their local policeman, he gave them the number to the UFO reporting center, because he didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
And then the Air Force was out of the UFO business. Blue Book was closed. So all we've got is the you know, some of the witness statements, you know, just a little bit of stuff, some of the things that were said to reporters before the UFO groups got a hold of it, and you know, the rest of it is all UFO reports. And so, you know, it's a lot of it's kind of tainted and presented through the UFO filter. And you know, what if this is just like, you know, what if this was some kind of you know, military tanker or troop transport, you know, and it was just a, you know, basically was a hit and run accident, and all this other baggage is hidden. So what I've been trying to do is, no matter what this case was, even the unlikely event that it's a hoax, I've been trying to investigate it in such a way that I can learn something about it, whether it's the way that the military hides information on UFO cases, you know, whether some of the problems with the investigation of UFOs. You know, hopefully things have gotten better, but one of the big... The key problem is this: the fact that a single investigator had control of it, and he was a part of a single UFO group, and it's just too dangerous for a single individual or group to control all the information and pretty much the access to the witnesses and the records, the medical records. You know, skeptics and people who supported the case and generally interested in helping the witnesses weren't allowed to review the medical records. And, you know, there's a whole lot of mythology about what it could show, whether it shows anything at all. And the more I've looked at kind of the shadow the medical report cast, you know, having a doctor who has looked at it talk about it, having excerpts from it. I haven't seen it itself, but I've heard really good summaries of it, including a letter by Dr. Rank to Vicki Landrum, and then his summary of it to John Schuessler. It just, you know, it's a description of the injuries, not a determination of what caused them, and no indication that it's radiation. Well, you wouldn't want a skeptic to control, a debunker in particular, to control all the case information. There's nothing to this. You don't need to see this report. It's just nothing happened. You wouldn't believe that. You shouldn't believe a UFO a reporter who says, well, I've got this report, and it shows that they were burned by a UFO, and, yeah, that's what happened, and, you know, it's right. A shame.
Yeah, 100% agree with you, and it's a, that approach is what I've tried to look at all this stuff for a long time, and it, you know, you go back and forth on things, but kind of dispassionately looking at the facts of any case is hard for an individual to do, especially if you're really interested in it. And I'm really interested in the UFO stuff, but I'm also really interested in not making a preconceived notion about what an unknown is, or being disappointed when an unknown becomes known, which I see a lot of prevalence of that. So I think we're pretty much in agreement on a lot of the philosophy of this. However, at the beginning of the show, you said there's stuff that you don't agree with me with. I don't want to fight with you because I never do with anybody. But what were you thinking of when you said that? And I don't mind. You mention whatever you like.
Well, you know, maybe I should have just said there's some things you talk about I don't understand. There's, you know, some things about the nature of reality and things like that. So maybe I shouldn't say I don't agree. There's some things I don't understand. And sometimes...
I don't either.
Maybe, you know, so...
I don't know if I do either. I think I question more than I try to question more than I think I have an answer. And so when it sounds, I dig deeper and deeper on stuff. I sometimes dig so deep that I don't even know what the hell I'm digging in anymore. And at that point I have to back out. But the thing is that, you know, I'm always trying to ask another question that either hasn't been asked very much, or if it has, people have poo-pooed it and I want to look at it again. You know, hence the connections with the drug stuff and the DMT and tulpas and, you know, all these things that have been hovering around UFO research probably from the beginning in different formats. And I think all of them are, you know, are equally valid because they're almost, all of them are almost equally unprovable. But some of them to me are more interesting than others. And that, I think, if that makes any sense, that's what my general approach is and why I say the things I do. I think I cheerlead for things. And I want somebody who has much more smarts than me to tell me if there's any validity to anything I'm cheerleading for, you see.
Well, it was something you said in there made me think about how almost everyone, there's this cliche about when you're all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But yeah. I kind of see a positive side of that, too. I mean, everyone who has a specific discipline looks at a problem, sometimes with limitations, but sometimes it gives them a new perspective on things.
Right.
And, you know, by only having UFO investigators look at a certain set of things, you know, especially the ones that are so rigid in their thinking. I came across an interesting quote in the same journal that summarized Schussler's first report, and apparently this guy's been discredited, but I thought he said something really interesting. His comment was about how UFO reports sometimes omitted details that didn't fit the rest of the story. What he was basically referring to is sometimes the experiences had some bizarre element. Well, I don't know. We'll just say maybe the aliens wearing a red derby or something.
Yeah.
An element that makes the story seem so ridiculous, you know, or the person, who knows, maybe there's a snow cone that's where it shouldn't be in the story.
Yeah.
But it's just something. And so the investigator just, well, you know, this is going to queer the deal, so let's just leave this out.
Yeah. And, oh, God, I can't stand that. I love the weird stuff like that because it's the part of the story that's the rebellious part of the story or of whatever the experience was or whatever was causing the experience. Because I think in at least some cases, there is an external reality to some of the things people experience. And if that includes something that doesn't make sense at all, I think that's really important. I mean, are our brains making that? Or is the thing that's causing it trying to confuse us with things like that? I mean, just throw a whole big wrench in it so it sounds even weirder and stupider than it normally would. I think that's fascinating. It excites me.
Yeah, there's. I think a lot of times, I don't know about those bizarre details, but I just know in conventional experiences, even like a car accident, sometimes you try to reconstruct it, and there are gaps, and trying to fill those in, sometimes you make the most. At least you will consider the most bizarre explanations for things that you don't understand.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think in some cases people incorporate that into their stories. That doesn't mean that nothing weird ever happens, but that means that sometimes we can fool ourselves in our perceptions. But the thing is, our brains are not recording devices, and the fact that we're capable of imagination and fantasy and confusion is what makes a lot of things puzzling. I mean, just regular life, not only
yeah,
these experiences.
Yeah, well, we have a incredible capacity to fill in the gaps. And if there's something that either is missing or we don't like or it didn't come in quite well, I think our subconscious and maybe other parts of our mind are perfectly willing to spackle those holes over with something that makes sense. Or maybe it doesn't make sense, but at least it bridges the gap, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, sometimes it's just, you know, that's your brain attempting to hang on to sanity to process an experience. And, you know, there's a lot of times, too, I mean, you know, I was talking about inventing experiences to a certain degree or explanations for them, but there's a lot of times where experiences are buried, and I'm not talking so much about, well, they're repressed, and not the hypnosis kind of thing. But just something like where something bad happened, you just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, it may fester, but that's a coping mechanism.
Right. Okay, we've got just a couple minutes left. Is there anything you wanted to ask me, or do you want to describe your site and where people can read it and get in touch with you? I mean, I guess I described it at the beginning, but.
There's definitely things I forgot to talk about, and there's
well, then we'll have you on again.
Things will need to be corrected, so I do hope they'll visit the site. And you know, most of the stuff we talked about, you know, is well, you know, I have a personality deficit disorder, but I do actually talk about lighter things sometimes. And one of those is my I had a relatively short friendship with Jim Moseley. I met him towards the end of his life, mm-hmm. but you know he was a good friend of mine. And I'm trying to promote this site that remembers him.
Oh yeah,
it's not an obituary. I mean we're recognizing the fact that he's passed on, but you know he was around the field for a huge number of years. I know he was a friend of yours, and I'm trying to present some of the photographs, some of the things that he did, whether they were serious or pranks, or but he made some serious contributions to the UFO field.
Well,
he was
definitely.
An interesting guy, and it's called JimMoseley.com, and it's in its infancy. It's patched together right now, but it's growing every day, and there's some pretty cool stuff up there, and I think it's kind of fun too. So I hope people will take a look at it.
Yeah, I think. Especially in the last few minutes here when Kurt and I were talking, a lot of Jim Moseley comes out in that because he had a big influence on me in the way he looks at things. I mean, when I first met him, I realized, oh, I guess I can laugh at a lot of this, can't I? You know, he just kind of said, hey, a lot of it's real funny. I mean, you got to admit that, right? And so, and that really kind of opened me up a little bit when meeting him that time.
Oh, one of the things I really liked about Jim, and it puzzled me for a long time, is that... he opened me to new ways of thinking. But one thing was, it's like he was good friends with some of the craziest contactee
yes.
believers.
Yeah.
And then he was friends with some of the most rabid debunkers. And I said, well, how can you do that? And he said, well, you know, I'm able to be friends with a person separate from their beliefs.
Yeah.
And he was interested in what they both had to say.
Right.
And so, you know, I've tried to learn from that, and you know there's like so you know everybody's worth listening to, I think, you know, unless they prove otherwise.
Exactly. Okay, Kurt, well thanks so much, and I think we talked about a lot of stuff on the phone that we didn't bring up on the show, and I'd like to talk about at another point if you're willing.
Oh sure, there's and like I say, there's other stuff. You know, I get involved in the intricacies of this, but you know, I've got some things that apply to other cases. So all you need to do is steer me in the right direction, because I do run off on tangents.
Yeah, I do the same thing. It's just because we know we're so excited about it. Still, I'm glad I am, especially talking to somebody like you. And there's so many little things that come up as you start talking that you want to include. So. It's, you know, you have to start thinking, what am I going to edit and keep it still interesting, you know. And but that's okay, because all I do on this show is ramble around with people, and I don't care if it's focused or not, or, you know, or it's if it's interesting to me, then it's still interesting. And so that's why I've enjoyed it, and I want to have you on again. Thanks so much, Kurt.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen. This is your flight captain, McKay. We're going on a space flight to Venus and Mars. So tighten your seatbelt and extinguish all cigarettes. Thank you.
Space flight to Venus and Mars. Apparently, we got to touch the stars and Venus. Taking off from London town to Venus and Mars. Traveling way out in outer space. Someplace I gotta find a new base. Really got no time to waste a tear. Going on a space flight, they say. Come and down with me, no matter what they say. Have to be your captain, my kids, I want you to be me. Extraordinary space flight, I will tell you. Got to hold on tight, I will tell you, baby girl. Right now you're out of this world. Taking you throughout the space, you gotta keep the smiles in your face. You could never erase. I'm going to Venus, and I will tell you.